Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1027. Send in the Clowns, Reflections on the Kavanaugh Circus. This is being recorded on October 9th of the year 2018. I have been asked many times whether I thought about the Kavanaugh proceedings before they really got underway. I was asked if I thought he would be confirmed, and I said, yes, I do think he'll be confirmed, even really before the FBI, quote, investigation, unquote. And I'm not only not surprised, but I feel a powerful onset of reverse peristalsis at the whole thing, aside from the fact that having Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court is less than enthralling, in my opinion. The entire procedure, I think, was disgusting and in a lot of ways that I don't think many people grasped. It was, well, I might as well get right into it. For one thing, I thought it was interesting, and this is not in any way to sanction what Kavanaugh did to Dr. Ford and or what he and associates apparently did to other women. I note that Kavanaugh and Judge Gorsuch went to the same high school, and I think it is not only interesting, but substantively relevant that an aspect of Judge Gorsuch's doings at Georgetown Prep and Kavanaugh's, I may not have the name of the school exactly right, but they went to the same elite Catholic prep school. And in the yearbook, Judge Gorsuch, or the man who was to become Judge Gorsuch, Neil Gorsuch, wrote about the Fascism Forever Club, being a member of that. And editors of the yearbook also discussed that. This was quickly dismissed because officials or former officials at the school said there was no formal organization called the Fascism Forever Club. However, it appears from the references to it that it was an informal group of reactionaries in the school, including Neil Gorsuch, who obviously thought that fascism was a subject for merrymaking and apparently not a bad thing past a point. That received almost no discussion and was quickly swept under the rug. And again, this is not to sanction what Judge Kavanaugh did, and I, for one, believe. Dr. Ford, she has been consulting with a psychiatrist about this. But I think it does say a lot about this society's values that one Supreme Court nominee who thought it was okay to joke about fascism when he was in high school received essentially no scrutiny on that subject, and yet certainly the sexual assault apparently on I guess at that time she was Christine Blasey is criminal in nature. A lot of what the discussion involved was the general rhetorical flatulence of Kavanaugh and his fellow members of the Jock Jr. Caveman Club talking about or joking in the yearbook about Renata Alumnius, an apparent reference to having achieved sexual conquest of a woman in a neighboring school. The fact that fascism forever received no discussion, I think, is sadly indicative of where we have gotten to. I'm going to get to Judge Kavanaugh and what he did when employed by the Georges Bush in a minute. That is incalculably more important than the situation with Dr. Blasey Ford, and I don't minimize that or dismiss it, but the drunken sexual assault on a young woman speaks for itself, but so does covering up mass murder, torture, terrorism, treason, the subversion of the economy. God knows how many people have lost their lives as a direct result of the activities in the George W. Bush administration and actually the George H.W. Bush administration that Judge Kavanaugh was involved with. We're going to talk more about that. But I think that the eclipsing of what Judge Kavanaugh was involved with by the Blasey Ford hearings and the alleged FBI investigation, and note my choice of words, really served to whitewash what Kavanaugh really was all about. I don't watch, as I have said before, and as veteran and regular listeners know, I don't watch television. It's not only physically bad for the brain, doesn't matter what you watch. You can watch nothing but Masterpiece Theater and the History Channel. It is still bad for your brain. It's not good for you, aside from the fact that you're going to expose yourself to so much foolishness. If I want to watch a bunch of foolishness, all I have to do is look out the window. It doesn't use electricity, and there are no commercials. I did. The television is, of course, a ubiquitous part of our society. I chanced to see about 15 minutes or so of Brett Kavanaugh's testimony at a social event because the TV was on. And, it was perhaps predictable. I suspected that he was going to come out swinging in the Donald Trump mode and act the aggrieved white male, and he did that with tears, etc. What I was struck by, and this is obviously altogether subjective, leaving aside the apparently rehearsed histrionics in which he engaged, just looking at the guy, not knowing anything about him, he's a sick puppy. And he is also, I mean, this guy is not well. And he is someone to be feared. He warned that the Democrats have sowed the wind for decades to come. That is a reference to a biblical passage. I have to paraphrase slightly, but he who soweth the wind shall reap the whirlwind. And boy, with Judge Kavanaugh and his ilk, they will be reaping the whirlwind indeed. The San Jose Mercury News on Sunday, and I made a link to it, but I'll just mention it in passing, really, I think there are two lead articles about the confirmation of Judge Kavanaugh, kind of encapsulated the way in which the coverage eclipsed much more important things, such as what Judge Kavanaugh was involved with when he was a pivotal, fundamental part of the George W. Bush administration, and also the, frankly, trivialized nature of the Kavanaugh hearings. Well, they had two articles, the Mercury News on Sunday, the 7th, did. One that was simply about the fact that Kavanaugh had been confirmed by the Senate. And the other was, you know, Dr. Ford's friends ask, where does she go from here? Well, that latter really isn't all that bloody important. And for what it's worth, I think she'll probably do very well for herself. Certainly she has experienced an ordeal, but my guess is that as something of an anointed political martyr, she will have some lucrative speaking engagements, a lucrative book contract, or maybe two, might have a made-for-TV and or major motion picture about her. Wouldn't surprise me if it starred Meryl Streep as Dr. Ford. On the balance, I think Dr. Ford will do relatively well. She will do one hell of a bloody lot better than the God knows how many lives are destroyed by the decisions that Brett Kavanaugh will be making on the Supreme Court. And she will be doing and has done a hell of a lot better than the millions of lives that have been destroyed or terminated by the actions of the George W. Bush administration. And Judge Kavanaugh was a fundamental, pivotal element of that administration. I also would note that someone who was not present for the interrogation or the questioning of Judge Kavanaugh, a former member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, was Al Franken, who was removed in one of the most grotesque political spectacles I have ever seen. He was an early victim of the, quote, hashtag MeToo movement, and I'll have some more to say in the follow-up program about that, because I'm going to attempt, very possibly unsuccessfully, to talk about what psychologists and sociologists refer to as pseudo-speciation and the psychological role of sexuality in politics and psychological warfare and how that, and propaganda, and how that embraces some of those concepts. But Al Franken was removed, basically, the Democrats, the very same Democrats who were wringing their hands and being so upset and politically correctly upset about Judge Kavanaugh. And certainly what he did, and I do believe Dr. Ford stinks, although, you know, the guy was drunk. And as someone who has been around, there's the old saying, instant a-hole, just add alcohol. A lot of people do things, including criminal things, when they are drunk that they would not normally do. Someone who is a Supreme Court judge should not have been allowed to get away with that, even as a drunken adolescent. But again, that pales beside the other things Kavanaugh has been involved in, not drunkenly and not as an adolescent, but under George W. Bush. Treason, apparently, not being the least of those. But Al Franken, and I talked about this in For the Record 998 and 999, Al Franken was removed from office, basically. He was asked to resign by Democrats in Congress because of some photographs and very dubious allegations. The main element in the political lynching of Al Franken was a photograph of him pretending, obviously, it's a gag photograph, to fondle the breasts of an apparently sleeping Leanne Tweeden on a USO tour. The photographer has stated that she was not actually asleep, and it's very clear from the picture, which is in For the Record 998, and I will link to that, that it was a gag. Franken would not have had a photographer there if, for the sake of argument, he was actually going to transgress in that manner. He is not actually touching Leanne Tweeden's breasts, and Leanne Tweeden is wearing a flak jacket, which is at the opposite end of the apparel spectrum from Victoria's Secret garments. It is ludicrous. On that same USO tour, Leanne Tweeden, who is a right-wing political animal, a creature from Fox News, according to her good friend, actor Tom Arnold, she is a birther. Leanne Tweeden is grabbing a male performer on stage, grabbing his rear end on stage, And that is on the same U.S. altar. There is also a picture of Al Franken holding up a skimpy women's undergarment and Leanne Tweeden mugging. You know, obviously the whole thing was tongue-in-cheek. Yeah, okay, you got to watch the way you phrase things in this context at this point in time. But the point being that that was obviously a gag. And Leanne Tweeden grabbed the butt of a male performer on this USO tour. But then that, you know, while I don't sanction things like that, hell, bloody hell, that is a USO tour. And entertainers are catering to the interests of a bunch of horny 20-something-year-old men, some of whom are in a theater of war, largely men. And so perhaps it is not to be, it is not unexpected. But that Al Franken could have been lynched by that. And then another photograph surfaced of him posing with a woman at the Minnesota State Fair. She claims that Al Franken was grabbing her butt at that time. That woman and her husband, who was present at the taking of this photograph, are supporters of Donald Trump. And her father was present as well. There is all this rhetoric about believe the women. I, for one, don't, quote, believe the women, unquote, simply because there is no such thing as a woman. Any more than I, quote, believe the men, unquote, there is no such thing as a men. There are individual men and individual women. I believe Dr. Ford. I do not believe Leanne Tweeden. And I don't believe the woman who alleges that, the Donald Trump supporter, that alleges that Al Franken was grabbing her rear end while having her picture taken by her husband or father. She's a Trump backer, so's her husband. Then there's a joking photograph of Al Franken hugging Arianna Huffington. Also, although she has the Huffington Post, a, quote, progressive, unquote, media outlet, she has a right-wing political heritage as well. She was married to Michael Huffington, a right-wing California senator who turned out to be gay, ultimately, this after he also was revealed to have been selling torture instruments to the Indonesian junta. Specifically, as I recall, cattle prods. Then the Huffington Post opened up a spot on their blog for anonymous accusers of Al Franken. That is the very worst sort of political star chamber. And the political lynching of Al Franken, and had he not been destroyed by something that is, well, really it reflects what Nietzsche observed when he said that a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. This should be a joke. It really goes to the essence of what author Edith Wharton said when she noted that, quote, a frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys. And that basically was what the destruction of Al Franken was all about. Franken said that he welcomed an official investigation into the charges against him. There was no such investigation. They didn't have something that shows that obviously gag photograph of Franken pretending to grope a flak jacket-wearing Leanne Tweeden, and they sure as bloody hell didn't look at Leanne Tweeden, not pretending to, but grabbing the rear end of a male performer on stage at that same USO tour. Was that consensual? Does that constitute sexual harassment? I think the answer is obviously yes, although the whole bloody thing was in the context of the post-adolescent hyperlibidinous flatulence that one would expect on a USO tour. I doubt the performer got real bent out of shape about that. Probably, you know, joked about it. Might have been flattered, whatever. The whole thing was really devoid of substance. And having Arianna Huffington open up her publication to anonymous charges against Al Franken, and then the very same Democrats who were beating their breast and tearing their hair in righteous indignation over Judge Kavanaugh called for the resignation of Al Franken, who then agreed to do just that. He said he welcomed an inquest. There was no inquest. It was a lynching. Reminds me of nothing so much, as I have said, as the play The Crucible by Arthur Miller. It is a parable. It is about the Salem witch trials, but really is an allegory about McCarthyism, and a bunch of adolescent young women get caught up in mass hysteria, some of which was apparently repressed or transferred sexual hysteria, and it basically leads to the killing of a bunch of people and the destruction of other people as well. This whole thing reminds me of, that is, the Judge Kavanaugh circuit, the Al Franken destruction, the political lynching of Al Franken reminds me of nothing so much as The Crucible. If you get the opportunity to see it, see a stage production of it, or buy the book and read the book. It is relevant. Al Franken would have been among the questioners of Judge Kavanaugh if he was still on the Senate Judiciary Committee, but he was not. He was destroyed in this circus, this absolutely ridiculous, hysterical, crucible-like crucifixion, to coin a phrase. It was so superficial and ridiculous, and the same Democrats who were all bent out of shape about Kavanaugh did not subject the charges against Al Franken to any sort of scrutiny whatsoever. And again, the picture of Franken allegedly groping Leanne Tweeden's breasts is an obvious gag. You haven't seen any hashtag Tweeden should resign movement. She is a reporter for KABC Radio in Los Angeles. If she grabbed a male performer's butt on that USO tour, why have people not called for her to resign? Anyway, I think Al Franken would have done a much more substantive, incisive job of questioning than the hacks who basically pitched batting practice to Kavanaugh on that hearing. As I have said, I certainly do not hold a brief of what he did to Dr. Forbes, and although I do not believe Leanne Tweeden or Arianna Huffington or the gal whose name I forget who alleges that, the Trump backer who alleges that Franken grabbed her rear end at the Minnesota State Fair in the presence of her Trump-backing husband and father who were taking the picture, I do not believe that at all. But what Kavanaugh did to Dr. Ford when she was Christine Blasey, although I don't certainly hold a brief for such things, it pales by comparison to the enormous destruction of humanity in which he was a very important part when he was part of the George W. Bush administration. There was an article in the Washington Post of August 24th of 2018. It is by Robert O'Harrow, H-A-R-R-O-W, Jr. Brett Kavanaugh, Bush's intellectual Bobby man, unquote. And this was on the public record long before the Christine Blasey and Dr. Ford material surfaced. I would note that the Republicans withheld thousands of pages of documentation on what Kavanaugh was doing. I'm going to excerpt this article. This is what Brett Kavanaugh was involved with. He had the title Staff Secretary. And the article, again, Brett Kavanaugh, Bush's Intellectual Body Man by Robert O'Hara Jr. from the Washington Post of August 24th of 2018. Quote, Kavanaugh, now President Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court, had an ordinary-sounding title, Staff Secretary. But he wielded extraordinary influence as an advisor responsible for screening, reviewing, and editing documents delivered to Bush, interviews, and documents show. skipping down. No justice in recent memory has worked as intently as Kavanaugh at the highest levels of the nation's political machinery, scholars said. Documents, skipping down again, documents and interviews show that while Kavanaugh was not a policy maker, he was directly involved in helping the White House manage a wide array of sensitive matters, including the war on terrorism. Skipping down again. Quote, it put Kavanaugh at the center of every political and policy decision at the Bush White House, said Peter Irons, professor emeritus at the University of California at San Diego and author of several books about the Supreme Court. Again, quoting, he is exactly the kind of person that the legal conservative movement wants on the court, unquote. Skipping down again. Kavanaugh was responsible for managing the process that helped shape the president's thinking and fuel the Bush administration agenda. Quote, he was everywhere, unquote, said Michael Gerson, G-E-R-S-O-N, a speechwriter in the Bush administration and now a syndicated columnist at the Washington Post. Skipping down again. Virtually every piece of paper had to pass through the staff secretary's hands, unquote, said Carl Rove. Since there was a lot of TV watching, that old Alka-Seltzer commercial, that's the sum of specie meatball, that is. How much destruction of humanity took place as a result of what Kavanaugh was pivotally involved with at the Bush White House? How many hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in Iraq as a result of what Kavanaugh did? Recalling that the Bush family have been business partners with the bin Laden family for decades, that the elder George Bush ran the Afghan Mujahideen against the Soviet Union in the 80s. That Mujahideen effort morphed directly into al-Qaeda. Most importantly, perhaps in my opinion, the suppression of Operation Green Quest on March 20th of 2002, FBI and Treasury Department agents raided a series of individuals and institutions that yielded information pointing directly toward people and institutions involved with Karl Rove and Grover Norquist's Islamic Free Market Institute, basically a parallel network to the Nazi element within the Republican Party that we have spoken about so often and that evolved from the Crusade for Freedom. The individuals and institutions who were busted on March 20th of 2002 heavily overlapped the bank Al-Taqra, headed up by Youssef Nava, an apparent former Nazi intelligence officer, and the driving force behind the bank Al-Taqra, which had an account that had an unlimited line of credit for Osama bin Laden, was François Genoux, heir to the collected literary works and political last will and testament of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. And that ultimately was swept under the rug. A guy named Talat, T-A-L-A-T, Osman, O-T-H-M-A-N, a former director of Harkin Energy, George W. Bush's, one of his energy ventures, a man who was a personal friend of and political advisor to both George's Bush, a man who was a political protege of Gaït Faron of the BCCI, interceded with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill because the Department of Treasury runs the Secret Service and a lot of the raiding was done by the Secret Service. Then Paul O'Neill was obliged to resign some months later. Then Robert Mueller, at the time head of the FBI, covered up Operation Green Quest. It went no place. I would note that the account again with an unlimited line of credit for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, had been managed by a guy named Ali bin Mousalim, who was conveniently found dead in his Geneva, Switzerland apartment about a month after that became public. And he had been under indictment in the U.S. in the early 80s for having attempted to corner the silver market. That places him in direct cahoots with Bunker Hunt and members of the ultra-right-wing Hunt oil family. Thinking about Iraq, thinking about September 11th, and how many people died in that, how many people have died in the Afghan war stemming out of the September 11th attacks, and with the Operation Green Quest raids, the complicity of elements of the Bush administration, people like Karl Rove and Grover Norquist, with institutions like al-Qaeda, like the Bank al-Taqwa, people like Youssef Nader, people like the late Francois Janoux, who, although he died in 1996, was deeply involved with the Bank al-Taqwa. It was a protege of his, friend of his, and attorney for the late Francois Janoux, Baldin Junot, who was a member of the board of directors of SICO, the Swiss-based holding company for the holdings of the corporate holdings of the Bin Laden company, and someone who was deeply involved with setting up the offshore fronts for the funding of the Afghan Mujahideen effort. Just Operation Green Quest, which was swept under the rug by the Bush administration and which would have certainly resulted in not just the indictment, but impeachment and conviction for treason and being accessories to God knows how many counts of first-degree murder that Kavanaugh has to have been involved with, and how many other things. How about the economic collapse? How many lives were destroyed by that? How many people committed suicide or got drunk and committed a crime? How many people died of cancer or some other disease because their lives were destroyed by the economic collapse? In For the Record 412, titled "The Engineer Intends to Wreck the Train," I recorded that in early June of 2003, and I stated in no uncertain terms that the engineer, in this case George Bush, with Brett Kavanaugh shoveling the coal as his fireman, intended to deliberately cause a financial crisis in order to basically get rid of programs they wanted to eliminate. The collapse of 2008 was not just foreseen, it was to a considerable extent deliberately engineered, again by engineer George W. Bush and his fireman and conductor Brett Kavanaugh, who was shoveling coal enthusiastically into the engine, the locomotive, during this administration. Again, I hold no brief for what he apparently did to Dr. Ford, but my God, compared to the enormous destruction of human beings, you know, millions, if you count the Iraq, Afghanistan, the things that grew out of Iraq, like the bloodbath in Syria, ISIS, the ongoing war in Afghanistan, September 11th, the economic collapse, and God knows how much else. But we didn't hear about that, did we? More about Brett Kavanaugh and Bush. This from Heavy.com blog of July 10th of 2018. And by the way, it wasn't just Brett Kavanaugh, but his wife, Ashley Kavanaugh, was deeply involved with George W. Bush as well. Brett Kavanaugh and George W. Bush, What Are the Ties For? By Jessica McBride. Again, Heavy.com, July 10th of this year, 2018. Judge Brett Kavanaugh, President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee to replace Anthony Kennedy, had long-standing ties to former President George W. Bush, as does his wife, Ashley Estes Kavanaugh. Both Brett and Ashley Kavanaugh served in the Bush administration, and Bush nominated Brett M. Kavanaugh to the position he currently holds on the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. Trump revealed Kavanaugh as his pick for Supreme Court on July 9th of 2018. Kavanaugh was one of four rumored finalists, with Judge Amy Coney Barrett, Judge Thomas Hardiman, and Ray Ketledge also among them. Because Trump and the Bush family have a publicized feud, some people thought Brett Kavanaugh's Bush ties could hurt his chances with the president. However, that did not stop the president from picking him in the end, even though some conservative infighting broke out over the pick. Now the Bush faction of the GOP and the Trump faction are united. They are working together. Skipping down. Here is what you need to know about Brett Kavanaugh's Bush ties. Brett Kavanaugh served as the staff secretary to George W. Bush. Brett Kavanaugh is a judge serving on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit Court. He's a graduate of Yale Law School who also spent time in private practice. A bio for Brett Kavanaugh also sketches out his ties, saying, quote, from July 2003 until his appointment to the court in 2006, he was assistant to the president and staff secretary to President Bush. Kavanaugh, the former staff secretary to George W. Bush, also played a role in drafting the Ken Starr report into the impeachment of former President Bill Clinton. When Kavanaugh was sworn in as a federal judge, Bush said, quote, for the past 5 years, he has served in the White House as associate counsel, a senior associate counsel, and as staff secretary. I would also note that Kavanaugh had served in the Solicitor General's office under Bush 1, George H.W. Bush, skipping down. He served in George H.W. Bush's administration in the Solicitor General's office. Well, George H.W. Bush's Solicitor General at one point was William Barr. I believe I'm going to put a question mark by that. William Barr was a, quote, ex-unquote CIA officer who resigned from CIA, ostensibly, when there was a mass firing under Jimmy Carter of former CIA officers. Skipping down about Kavanaugh's wife. Ashley Estes Kavanaugh, the spouse of Brett Kavanaugh, has deep ties to the administration of George W. Bush as well. Her links to Bush go back to his days as Texas governor. According to her LinkedIn page, Ashley Estes Kavanaugh worked as media relations coordinator for the George W. Bush Presidential Center from 2009 to 2010, worked as director of special projects for the George W. Bush Presidential Foundation from 2005 to 2009, was President George W. Bush's personal secretary from 2001 to 2005. Wonderful. His George W. Bush's personal secretary from 2001 to 2005, was an assistant in the White House from 2001 to 2005, and worked on the Bush-Cheney 2000 campaign from 1996 to 2000. Her time with Bush dates to his work in Texas as governor there. She was assistant to Governor George W. Bush from 1996 to 1999. So Ashley Kavanaugh was George W. Bush's personal secretary when so much of this was going on. In a series of interviews, For the Record 7:11 through 7:16, and again in For the Record 7:30, I interviewed Russ Baker, the author of Family of Secrets, to understand what the Bush family has been all about. Read that book and read John Loftus and Mark Aron's The Secret War Against the Jews. The misdeeds of the Bush family go back to the funding of Adolf Hitler and George Herbert Walker, W's grandfather or great-grandfather, and the grandfather of George H.W. Bush, and proceeds on up through a great many things. George Herbert Walker and his son-in-law, Prescott Bush Sr., the father of George H.W. and grandfather of George W. Bush, was involved also with Union Bank and the Pearson Nexus, helping to fund Adolf Hitler. And also then U.S. Senator Prescott Bush was Alan Dulles' go-to man for the favors he needed for his CIA. And the sins of this family, and this administration could not be exaggerated. Recalling Talat Altman, a former director of Harkin Energy, who interceded on behalf of the individuals and institutions who were busted on March 20th of 2002 for funding terrorism, including Al-Qaeda. And that was eventually swept under the rug. He, again, Talat Altman was a director of Harkin Energy. Recall that in For the Record 569, Rita Katz, who helped to generate the investigation that resulted in the Operation Green Quest raids, as did John Loftus. She and others who had helped to precipitate that investigation found themselves under surveillance by the FBI and the CIA. Eventually, the people involved with the targets of that got off scot-free. Bearing that in mind, we're going to listen to an excerpt from, For the Record, 715. That is one of the interviews with Russ Baker about his landmark book, Family of Secrets, and this was done in the spring of 2010. And we're going to hear about Harkin Energy and what a mysterious company it was. And bear in mind that, again, Talat Altman, who helped to quash Harkin Energy, helped to quash Operation Green Quest, rather, had been a director of Harkin Energy, which was a very mysterious company, which appears to have been a money laundering vehicle, including, very possibly, for some of the gold bullion that was stashed in the Philippines by General Yamashita, and that was the focal point of the landmark text, Gold Warriors, by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. We've done many programs about that. From For the Record 715, here is a little of the background on Harkin Energy.
Tell us about Arbusto Energy.
Right. Well, the father, you know, had gone out there, and then, see, they're very, very cognizant, as I think Barack Obama was too, of how you create a story that resonates well with people. A lot of people, when you talk about Obama and you try to stress that his establishment credentials, they'll say, but wait a minute, he was a, you know, he was a neighborhood organizer. And then you say, well, of course. I mean, if you want to run for office, you have to do something like that. You've got to do something. Public service. I mean, he wasn't in the military, and so he needed something else. It's the same thing with the Bushes. They were very, very aware that they, you know, being born with a silver spoon and all that, they would be attacked for that. So they, the simple thing is to immerse yourself, you know, get your hands dirty. And so Poppy had gone out to Texas, and they created this story about how he worked his way up from the bottom, which was not true. Very much, he was even flown out there on a family corporate jet. I mean, everything was made very easy for him. And the son was the same thing. So the son tells the story of how he, you know, headed out to West Texas and started his little tiny business in a broom closet sized room and just struggled from the bottom. But actually, I've studied the records of the company, and you just see one person after another marching in there, writing giant checks. In fact, one fellow came in and he flew in. He was James Baker's college roommate from Princeton, and he flew in and said, here's a check for $1 million. Now, keep in mind, this is in the early 70s, and that's still pretty big money, but back then, to just fly in with a check for $1 million into something, it was a total crapshoot. And then the lawyer, the outside lawyer, said to him, now I need to explain to you the risks involved. And he said, oh, according to the lawyer, this guy said, oh, don't bother, it's not my money.
Well, there you go. Nice work if you can get it. And he got it. However, Arbusto Energy didn't turn out to be a particularly profitable oil company. Again, I want to hearken, pun intended, back to some of our earlier discussions about Bush family business ventures, that they don't make a lot of sense from an overt business standpoint, but that when one dollies the camera out, as you have done so effectively in Family of Secrets, Russ Baker, what you see all over with business connections of really several generations generations of Bushes, you see intelligence connections, big time, as Dick Cheney would say. Arbusto didn't go too far. How about Spectrum 7? Tell us about that development.
Right. So what happened with Arbusto was Jim Bath comes in with some money, and as best as we can figure, anything that he had or that he was investing was on behalf of the Saudis. And so there's the very real possibility that the Saudis secretly put a substantial amount of money, not just into these things involving Bath, but actually into George W. And that would be very important in understanding his policies and his activities as president of the United States vis-a-vis the Saudis, Iraq, and so forth. Anyway, so Arbusto did not make money, was in trouble. Then along came a larger company called Spectrum 7 that bought it out. I encourage people to read the part in Family of Secrets about the figures behind Spectrum 7. They were Cincinnati businessmen, again connected into Yale. They were involved later on with a very interesting reinsurance company with what appear to be intelligence ties. That's a very complex way of also involving large amounts of money. And the, one of them was appointed when George W. Bush became president of the United States to the president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, despite the fact he seemed to know nothing about any of that. And so that's Spectrum 7. They give him a nice salary. They've taken his money-losing company. Spectrum 7 isn't making any money. And so eventually it is swallowed up in turn by this company, Harkin Energy, which is by far the most fascinating.
Let's talk about the Quashes, Father William and Son Alan, and how they figure into this scenario.
Harkin Energy was a small and I think sort of regular, you might say, oil company. I flew out to Texas and spent some time in person with the man who had founded it, Phil Kendrick, and he took me through the whole history of the company. He grew up in the oil industry, and it was a viable oil company. But when the oil industry fell on hard times, he began looking for outside financing. And when he had a subsidiary in Asia, and as he was traveling around Asia, somehow the name Quasha had come up, and he'd heard about a man named Quasha, an American who'd lived most of his adult life in the Philippines, and somebody had told him how Quasha was thought of to be some sort of a front for the vast billions of the Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos. Who, of course, those were ill-gotten gains of money transferred from the impoverished people of the Philippines, as well, of course, American tax dollars and so forth, to Marcos. In any case, that was the father, Quasha. Now, along comes a broker from the East Coast, contacts Kendrick and says, I've got somebody who'd like to invest in your company. And he says, great. And he says, yeah, this guy, Alan Quasha. And so this turns out to be the son of the man he'd already heard about in connection with Marcos. Quasha begins taking a position in the company, takes in more and more. The money comes in indirectly from various Caribbean entities, some of it blocks of stock, I think, in the names of, I have to check again, but I believe the mother and the father, not clear where they would get that kind of money themselves. But in any case, they eventually basically oust Kendrick from his own company, and they go about announcing that the company is doing really, really badly. The stock plummets. They're able to buy more stock at a fraction of the price, and he's out. And then the company begins doing all kinds of interesting things. It makes a deal with George Soros. He had a bunch of loose oil properties. It takes those over, puts him into the company. And then a few years later, it takes over Spectrum 7 and brings George W. Bush into the company. This is in the late 80s as Marcos is battling for survival in the Philippines. And Bush's father is vice president of the United States. And so they bring him in, they rescue Bush, they give him the best salary he's ever had, and they put him on the board, and they basically require him to do almost nothing at all. And he just takes off and essentially moves to Washington, where he ends up being key senior staff on his father's presidential campaign. And so this Harkin Energy Company is very much set with tremendous influence with that family. And Harkin's quite interesting because, and we can only scratch the surface here, but in Family of Secrets, I have a whole chapter on it where I go into all the people who are involved. And again, we find Saudis, we find people with connections to the Shah of Iran, of Fernand Marcos, of the South African apartheid regime, the white supremacist, the exclusive elite of South Africa, a Swiss bank, on and on and on. And many of these figures having intelligence connections, oil connections, connections to dictators. And it's an intriguing outfit. And then finally, as the company needs still more money, Harvard University comes in. And that is probably the most interesting of all, and that's why I devote, I'd say, almost half the chapter to Harvard. And what was it doing in this fascinating entity?
Yeah, just very briefly, Robert Stone, the head of the Harvard Management Corporation, another member of the old boy network of the Eastern financial and industrial establishment. Encapsulate him to the extent that one could, perhaps.
Well, I mean, the Boston Globe, the main newspaper in Boston, had looked at this thing. Time Magazine, Wall Street Journal, they all looked at Harkin and collectively adjudged it to be this one of the strangest things they'd ever seen. Didn't seem to make any money, didn't make any sense. Yet exploded. It went from just a few million to something like a billion in revenues, and the question was, what is this thing? It was gobbling up all kinds of companies and so forth, but it wasn't clear what it was exactly and why it very seldom made any money for the outside shareholders. Just very mysterious. And it also, by the way, had a lot of things that we would later see with Enron, these complex sort of, you know, separate related partnerships where they were moving profits and losses conveniently for the various entities and partners. But in any case, Robert Stone, he was the reason his name comes up is looking at why Harvard University made the largest investment it ever made in direct private equity investment into this tiny little and unprofitable company. They were trying to figure that out, and they got as far as to the fact that the head of the Harvard Board of Overseers, probably the single most powerful person at Harvard, a man named Robert Stone, might have had something to do with that. Now, he denied it in a very cagey way, and I do a lot of, in Family of Secrets, a lot of assessing the splitting of hairs, the parsing of words, where people are not explicitly lying, but they're being very careful in the way that they couch things to make it hard for us to figure out what's really going on. Robert Stone made it sound like he was nothing. That was the end of the reporting by the mainstream media, but I continued looking, and basically what I discovered was that Robert Stone had an intelligence background himself. And this went all the way back to World War II when I discovered he had worked for General Douglas MacArthur, as I think we pointed out in an earlier episode, did Poppy Bush when he worked in basically naval intelligence during the war. And so Robert Stone was also in the same group, as was William Quasha. So Stone and Quasha both worked on General MacArthur's staff at the same time. General MacArthur running his own intelligence operation in the Pacific and keeping the OSS largely out. So all these people knew each other. And what I finally discovered that seemed to connect all of these things was gold.
You know, one of the things you speculate about, and by the way, veteran and regular listeners of the program are very familiar with Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagraves. I've read at length from the book and have interviewed both of them on the air. You speculate that, and it is a speculative element, we should stress that, is that the Harkin may have been used as, you go into Harkin as apparently a money laundering vehicle at great length, but one of the speculative elements is that it may have been used to launder some of the gold that was left by General Yamashita, and certainly Bob Stone had a tremendous involvement with the gold industry.
Right. There's a lot of sense that there was gold. I mean, there is gold in the world. And when there's a war, the victors often take the gold. And we do know that the Japanese took gold. We know that the Nazis took gold. The Japanese took the gold, which, was a mainstay of the treasury of so many of these countries that they invaded, and that supposedly moved it, they wanted to keep it somewhere safe, and that the Philippines was where they kept it. There also, the Philippines was a very important gold mining country in its own right. And so there was this reputed, you know, several different sources of vast amounts of gold. And of course, if you have vast amounts of gold, they, you know, as they say, he who has the gold rules. So the gold is a very important means, again, potentially of funding unauthorized covert operations. And this is a consistent theme in Family of Secrets, the idea that the intelligence apparatus writ large is not under control, and it does whatever it wants, or more appropriately, I should say, it does whatever people in the private sector who have influence inside it want it to do. And the problem is, how do you fund these things? And so you can't fund them openly, you can't fund them using tax dollars, and you can't have the funds being traceable. Well, one of the best ways to do that is in the form of things like gold, which is not easily traceable, and especially if you've got a whole lot of gold that nobody knows even exists. It could be an endless store for your budget. And so I do find gold patterns, and we even see with the junior Quasha years later that he ends up on the board of, I can't remember, it was American Express Gold Fund, and, you know, we find Stone's connections to gold. We find gold running through all this, and we find also that some of the key investors in Harkin are people from South Africa, again, the number one supplier of gold in the world. And so it's gold, gold, gold all the time, and one wonders whether that was not the whole purpose of the entity in the first place.
You mentioned William Quasha briefly, known to this audience as is the lawyer for the Philippine branch of the Nguyenhan Bank, another of these drugs and intelligence connected banks that we've spoken about. In connection with this networking that we've been talking about, in a sense we're almost looking at the Gold Boys Network.
So again, Harkin Energy, very mysterious firm indeed, and Talat Atman was deeply involved with it. And that, and the cover-up of Operation Green Quest was but one of the many things that Brett Kavanaugh has to have been pivotally involved with. Saudi Arabian power politics figure prominently in the misdeeds of the Bush administration. I'm going to go back to the book Who Killed Polly by Frank Spearing. We listened to part of an interview with him in For the Record 1001, although I certainly don't hold a brief for the kinds of things done to Dr. Ford. They pale by comparison to some of the things, the horrors visited on women, like this from Who Killed Polly by Frank Spearing, copyright 1995. To reiterate Ernie Allen's statement, 300 girls, Polly's and Kate's age, are disappearing yearly throughout the U.S. It is a growing epidemic, a conspiracy that threatens every family in America. No little girl is safe. The worst part was told to this author by a witness named Jill Murray, M-U-R-R-A-Y, who had visited Saudi Arabia. Jill's father, since deceased, was there on a covert military operation. She said she could not mention the actual towns as she still has friends living there and, quote, they would be killed, unquote. I asked her who would kill them. She answered, the Saudis, skipping down. Jill saw brothels where children were kept. The brothels were plain-looking buildings in the center of the town with yellow doors. Men constantly came in and out, mostly Arabs from the oil fields, but men from other businesses as well. Jill peeked past the yellow door into one of the brothels and saw a room filled with young girls, white-skinned, about 12 years old. She learned that many of them were Americans abducted and shipped from the U.S. The little girls were wearing small, skimpy, see-through skirts. A customer would pick one of them and take whomever he wanted upstairs. Later, Jill saw some of the girls getting air in the back of the brothel. She could tell they were drugged by the way they walked. Although she never learned who ran the brothels, she found out that in 2 or 3 years the little girls were turned out into the streets where they were left to die. I asked Jill if she ever reported what she saw, little girls who were drugged and forced into sexual slavery. She admitted that she had to someone in the diplomatic corps. He said he would see what could be done about the abducted American girls, but to her knowledge, nothing was ever done. Why weren't the questions surrounding Polly's kidnapping answered? One has the feeling there is a devastating secret behind all of them. Yeah, and I don't expect that the Democrats who called for the ousting of Al Franken behind that adolescent flatulence will do anything about it. Hashtag Me Too won't do anything about it. Gloria CIA Steinem won't do anything about it. And nobody else will either, because this, and again, I don't sanction what was done to Dr. Ford, but that pales by comparison to some of the horrors visited on young women in this case. And, well, we won't hear about that, because this cuts across the Saudi American power structure, and that, as no one knows better than Brett Kavanaugh, is inviolable. This concludes For the Record program number 1027. Send in the Clowns, Reflections on the Kavanaugh Circus. This is being recorded on October 9th of 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.